Well, I'll start as always and say Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
So I'm curious this morning, how many of you looked ahead to find the next set of direct quotes in your Bible from God and read them prior to coming today? Well, if you did or if you didn't, I'm sure this is what you were all expecting today. But it's not to be. Not to be. I decided to pause this series and instead give some meat in due season. A few times in the past, I have, during this time of year, given messages and spoken about a holiday that is quickly approaching. At this point, everyone in this room and probably online understand all about the pagan origins of Saturnalia and what's fondly called today Christmas by our current culture. We know its origins, we know its traditions, and therefore we know its roots in idolatry, and so we, of course, have nothing to do with it. And I'm not going to speak about that today either. Because it's not the only holiday that's celebrated this time of year. There's another one, one that I have not taken much time to talk about in the past. So today I want to ask the question, what about Hanukkah? What about Hanukkah? It's sometimes referred to as the Festival of Lights. It's a reference to Someday Apple will make a deal that will stay connected. For some reason, it never seems to want to. Okay, it's about. Yes. Hanukkah. And if you didn't have a little spit come out, you didn't say it right. Like I said, it's sometimes referred to the Festival of Lights, and it's a reference to lighting of the menorah in the rededicated temple. And according to the Google calendar, which I'm pretty sure is 99% wrong anyway, the 8 days of Hanukkah ended yesterday. And while Christmas is deemed a Christmas or a Christian holiday, in like manner, Hanukkah is deemed a Jewish holiday. And they're both around the same time here at the end of the year. I don't know what's happening. I may have to go down. We may have to start over. I may have to go down and reset that thing. I'm going to have to probably get in the habit of resetting it every week. I don't know why it does it. It's very frustrating. Okay, back up. Some who have come to understand the origins of Christmas and distance themselves from it, like we do, choose to take on Hanukkah as a substitute, something to celebrate around the same time of year. Others say that it's only for the Jews. Is it merely Jewish? What is its origin? Is it biblical? Why is it 8 days long? What is its meaning? And should we, as spiritual Israelites, be observing it? Are there any valuable lessons to be learned here? These are some of the questions I want to address today as we ask, what about Hanukkah? Okay. The very first thing that I want to say about Hanukkah is what it is not. Okay, I want to set that right up front. It is not listed in Leviticus 23 or anywhere else in your Bible as a feast to the Lord. Yehovah never said, as he did with the other holy days, with the holy days, that Hanukkah is one of my feasts. So I want to make that point right up front. Hanukkah has no Sabbaths, no time. It's not an appointed time. It's not set apart. It's not sanctified as holy. And it is not again designated as a feast to the Lord. Its designation as a festival was decreed by men, leaders of the religion of Judaism. Now, having said that, though, there is some rich biblical history around this holiday, okay? And there's some great things that we can learn from it. Hanukkah is the Hebrew word for dedication. It means dedication. In fact, the celebration is called the Feast of Dedication in the New Second Testament. I can't talk today for some reason. John 10, verse 22 says, "Now it was the Feast of Dedication in Jerusalem, and it was winter. And Yeshua walked in the temple in Solomon's porch." Now this is referring to Hanukkah, because Hanukkah means dedication. That's how it's translated. The Greek word means dedication, or the Hebrew word means dedication. So when they translated it to Greek, it's dedication from Greek then to English. All right. So some will teach you that Yeshua went to the temple to observe Hanukkah, and that we should follow his example. Now, personally, I don't see that in this passage. To say that Yeshua was in the temple at the same time as Hanukkah is not the same as saying that Yeshua was in the temple for Hanukkah. It's not the same thing. And none of the following text from there down has any mention of the celebration, has any context towards that celebration. So this of and by itself is not conclusive. In my opinion, you would need other corroborating scriptures to give indication that he was actually keeping it. Something that would indicate somewhere in the Bible that God ordained it. We have no such thing. This appears to me just to be a reference for the time of year. Hanukkah started well before Yeshua's time, but much later than the revelation by God to the Israelites at Sinai of the actual holy days. Okay, so that was much later. Things progressed. Then you get to this event that's commemorated by Hanukkah, and then another couple hundred years and you have Yeshua. So I want to start here a little bit by giving some history, right? It's 330 BC, and this is over 300 years, about 300 years before Yeshua. Alexander the Great had conquered much of the known world, including Palestine and Jerusalem. Alexander the Great, despite his conquering nature, ended up being a pretty good king. He allowed Palestine and Jerusalem and all the other states and areas to really maintain their own culture if they chose to. He did not come and project and push the Greek culture onto all of those places, right? He allowed them to remain somewhat autonomous, meaning they could do, you know, pretty much what they want culturally. He didn't force them to take the way of the Greeks, to be Hellenized, as it's called. And this sounds good. But what happened? In that environment, the Jews became somewhat complacent, right? They slowly, over time, absorbed the culture that was around them. Even though it wasn't forced, they absorbed it. And so many became Hellenized anyway. And guys, we should be able to relate to that. Our country here began with very strong biblical values. That's why we came for religious freedom. And so then here we are, a few hundred years later, and it's just getting absorbed, right? I'm going to have more to say on that later, because today the church doesn't look that much different than the rest of society, does it? That's what happened there. Okay. So now, after Alexander the Great came Antiochus IV Epiphanes. And when he took over the reign, he was completely opposite of Alexander the Great. Completely opposite. Totally. He not only wanted to rule the people and have conquests, but he had a real desire to force his culture, his ways, his religious beliefs and everything onto the people. He wanted them to conform 100% to his ways. He had what you might call a God complex, right? In fact, Epiphanes actually means God manifest. I believe that he thought that he was the physical representation and embodiment of the spirit of Zeus. So he felt himself that way, okay? And so he ruled that way. And he was kind of a weirdo. The people within around him actually nicknamed him, and it was a play on words. I mean, his name is Antiochus Epiphanes. And so this word Epiphanes, as I said, means God manifest. But they just changed it a little bit, and they called him Antiochus Epiphanes. Okay, it's like a play on words. And that word means the mad one. Okay, I thought he was nuts. But anyway, he had this desire to stamp out Judaism. And in this persecution, he went into the temple in Jerusalem, massacring Jews on the way, massacring anyone. Well, I can't talk today. That got in his way, right? And so once to the temple, he erected an altar to the Greek god Zeus. On the altar for the great god Jehovah, in the temple. By legal decree, he prohibited the practice of Judaism and abolished, made it against the law, penalty death, to practice any of the ways of Judaism, anything contained within the Torah. For example, we know that circumcision is commanded. So if you had the nerve to go ahead and circumcise your child, whoever circumcised that child would be put to death. The family would be put to death. The child would be put to death. The mother would be put to death. Wipe them out. You circumcise them, you wipe them out. What he would do is he would take the baby, he'd kill the baby, and then he would have the baby tied to the breasts of the woman and march her around and then kill her, or kill her and then display her and march her around. The mad one. Okay? So then back in the temple, which is now obviously overrun by Antiochus, he placed a pagan priest in the temple. A Greek Hellenistic priest in the temple of the great God. It's a terrible thing. He declared Jehovah's temple to now be the temple of Zeus. And that's then when he erected this altar, this statue and everything of Zeus, on the altar of God inside the temple. And so now they have this idol in the temple, and they're sacrificing pigs, swine, to this idol. Can you think of a more complete way to desecrate the temple? It was an abomination which made the temple desolate of the presence of God. Sound familiar? That same thing was prophesied, of course, in Daniel, and it's prophesied to happen again in the last days. We'll talk more about that later. But sacrificing swine in the temple of the great God is an abomination in the temple, and it made it desolate of God's presence. God's no longer going to dwell there. Are you kidding me? So it's desolate due to these false gods, these idols, and false worship in his temple. All that's going to occur again. But that's not all. In the pagan religion, we've talked about this many times, you have the prostitutes, okay? They came into the temple. They began their services according to that religion that we've talked about in the past. All of this and more happening inside the temple of the great God. It's not a good scene. Now, there were two main groups that opposed Antiochus Epiphanes. And that is Judah Maccabee, his father, and also the, Hasidim. The Hasidim at that point are the group that later became the Pharisees. Okay, they were basically, the Hasidim was the Jewish leadership at the time. Okay, so there are several books in the Apocrypha called the Maccabees, okay? They're not in the biblical canon, but they are historical books, and they give us a lot of information on these events. And so here's a brief look at some of the things I've covered so far. This is in 1 Maccabees, chapter 1, starting in verse 54. The 15th day of the month, Kislev. I don't know why it's, there must have been a different way of spelling it. I don't know how to pronounce that, but I know it's Kislev, so I put Kislev. Anyway, in the 140th and 5th year, they set up the abomination of desolation upon the altar and builded idol altars throughout the city of Judah on every side and burnt incense at the doors of their houses and in the streets. And when they had rent in pieces the books of the law which they found, they burned them with fire. That's the Torah scrolls. That's what we call the Old Testament, the Tanakh. And whoever was found with any, the book of the Testament, or if any committed to the law, the king's commandment was that they should put him to death. Thus they did by their authority unto the Israelites every month to as many as were found in the cities. Now the 25th day of the month they did sacrifice on the idol altar, which was upon the altar of God. At which time, according to the commandment, they put to death certain women that had caused their children to be circumcised. And they hanged the infants about their necks and rifled their houses and slew them that had circumcised them. Howbeit, many in Israel were fully resolved and confirmed in themselves not to eat any unclean thing. So there were some that were strong and were maintaining the faith. Therefore, they chose rather to die that they might not be defiled with meats and that they might not profane the holy covenant. And so then they died. And there was very great wrath upon Israel. So we have this really horrible situation going on. And like I said, Judah Maccabee and his father, along with the Hasidim, began an uprising against Antiochus. And it's rather interesting how this revolt got started, how it got its impetus, okay? In the book of Maccabees, we read at one point that Judah Maccabee, who is nicknamed, by the way, the Hammer. What a cool nickname, right? Anyway, He was in the temple with one of the soldiers of Antiochus. There was a rabbi there as well. And the soldier, on orders from the king, was told at that point, on that day, to go ahead and sacrifice another pig on the altar to Zeus. Well, Judah wouldn't have anything to do with it. He refused. So the soldier turned to the rabbi and asked the rabbi to do it. He asked a rabbi to sacrifice a pig to a false god, Zeus, on the altar of the true great God, Yehovah. Can you imagine? What happened next is kind of interesting because Judah refused to do it. Judah Maccabee refused to do it. But interestingly, the rabbi did not. The rabbi went ahead and did it. And that gives you an indication of how far you can slide and how the environment around and the culture can affect you. He goes ahead and does it. Now, what Judah does next is really amazing. He didn't just stand by. You know, this whole thing about, you know, evil happens when good men do nothing. That wasn't Judah Maccabee, okay? He pulled his sword and he killed the soldier and the rabbi. Wiped them both out. Righteous indignation, okay? And he, of course, ran. And so we kind of have this connection there between Moses and Judah Maccabee, because Moses did the same thing, didn't he? When he was in Egypt, he was out and he saw one of the Egyptian soldiers beating one of his brethren, an Israelite, and in righteous indignation, this ain't right, and so he killed him. Well, but then the king, of course, is going to come after him. So what did he have to do? He had to run. Okay, same with Judah Maccabee. He killed the soldier. He also killed the rabbi. Now Antiochus Epiphanes is after him. He hears about it. So he has to run. And in both cases, we have a very similar thing. Moses goes out into, you know, the and he has to prepare for what God has for him to do. Took a lot of years, okay? Moses didn't even know he was preparing for something, but God knew he was preparing for something. Sometimes he does things in our lives and we wonder, what in the heck is he doing, right? But he's preparing us for something that we don't understand later. Same with Judah Maccabee. He had to run. But then at that point in time, he was in this position where then he began to put together an uprising and a rebellion against Antiochus, him and his father and the Hasidim. Okay? And so then they did this. They had this rebellion. They had undoubtedly a lot of help from Yehovah. And ultimately they were successful. They were able to regain the temple, to drive all of that out, and to defeat Antiochus. They won. And that, guys, is the central focus of Hanukkah. Because once they had the temple back, it needed cleansed. It needed purified. It needed the idols taken out, all the desecration taken out, and then it needed to be rededicated back to the true God. And that's why Hanukkah is what it is. Hanukkah means dedication. So all Hanukkah is all about the rededication of the temple after it was gained back from this mad king. And so once they got it back, they declared, the Jews, the Hasidim, declared an 8-day festival to be kept at the same time each year to commemorate the rededication of the temple. God did not declare that. The Jews did. The Hasidim declared that. And again, they're the ones that later became the Pharisees, part of the ruling group of Judaism. And so you have to ask yourself, well, why an 8-day festival? Well, if you get on the old Google, okay, I got started on this because I was looking at some news things, and our supposed president elect or vice president elect Kamala Harris put out a video talking about her support and how she viewed Hanukkah, which was ridiculous. But anyway, that's what got me thinking about all this. Anyway, when you get on good old Google, and you will probably find a pretty inspiring story about lamps and oil and such. Because as the tradition goes, when they lit the menorah, you know, inside the inner room, okay, there's a menorah, there's a showbread, and there's the incense. And when they got control back of the temple, they went to light the menorah. And the menorah in the Torah, the menorah is not to ever go out. It's part of the job of the Levites, of the priesthood, to make sure that menorah, it's a light, it's a perpetual, it's supposed to be a perpetual light. And so that was their job. They took care of the showbread, they burned the incense, they kept the menorah lit, okay? But as the tradition goes, they only had enough oil for one day when they lit it. But that one day's oil lasted the whole 8 days of the festival. This wonderful, supernatural intervention, and as they view it, a confirmation of Hanukkah. All right. Now, I know they've been severely persecuted, and once they got in there, maybe they only had enough to last a day. But this tradition says that it's supposed to last all the time. It's an inspiring story, but I think it's just a story. I think it's just a story. Well, why do I say that? First off, if you knew as a Levite priest that once you light that thing, it's not supposed to go out, and you only have a day's worth of oil, are you going to light it? I'm not. I'm going to say, hey guys, go get us some more oil. We got to have enough to keep this thing going, right? I wouldn't have lit it. That's me, okay? If it must remain lit, and you only have a day's worth of oil, why are you going to light it until you can do it? Secondarily, and this is something else. If you have this great, amazing story, this supernatural thing that happened, why is there no mention of it whatsoever in the Maccabees? The books that tell this whole story. Okay? Why no mention of it whatsoever? There's no mention of it in the Bible. There's no mention of it of any historical books. Josephus, any of them, don't mention any of this until the 4th century. So some rabbi in, I think it was 350 AD, finally wrote about this amazing thing. So, I don't know. Is it true? Could be, but I think it's on pretty shaky ground. So, if that's not the reason for the 8 days, why 8 days? Why is this an 8-day holiday? Well, there's a few things in the Bible that would point to why they chose 8 days. And many, even many Jews wonder why it was 8 days. So I'm not alone in thinking the story is just a story. It's a tradition of men, in my opinion. The first might be circumcision. Remember, they were prohibited by penalty of death from performing circumcision, along with any other Torah command. When are we to circumcise? Genesis 17 says, he who is 8 days old among you shall be circumcised. Male, every male child in your generations, he who is born in your house or bought with money from any foreigner who is not your descendant. So when a child is 8 days old, they are to be circumcised and dedicated to the Lord. So they're rededicating the temple, and they celebrated 8 days of dedication, like circumcision. So agreeably, there's a little bit of synergy here. Okay, but it's not really the reason. That might be a pattern, might be something to compare it to, but I don't think it's the reason. The next one would point to it be related to the Feast of Tabernacles, which is also an 8-day celebration. Now, these people were being forced to abandon their practices, okay? Or face death, so some of them went ahead and died. and some of them relinquished and they abandoned their practices. So they hadn't kept the feast, at least not openly and at the temple, for several years. So they had just missed one. This is Kislev. This is, you know, right around now. And, you know, we just had the feast a couple months ago. So they had missed the feast again. And now here they are at the temple. They're excited to have the temple back. So let's party. You know, let's just relive the feast here at the temple. And you can appreciate that. Because with the temple back, with control of it, they were probably very eager to recapture the joy and the celebration of the feast that they had just missed. And we're not guessing at this because there's some evidence of this attitude in Maccabees. There's actually a reference to this. Notice something here. Here in 1 Maccabees, when they rededicated the temple. Now on the 520th day of the ninth month, which is called the month of Kislev, in the 148th year, they rose up betimes in the morning and offered sacrifice according to the law upon the new altar of burnt offerings which they had made. They had some discussions. What do we do with this altar? Of course, they took Zeus off of it, and then you've got this altar, but now it's been desecrated. Can we rededicate this altar or what? What do we do? So what they did was they took all of those stones and they put them over in a safe place until they could get a judgment on it, and they built a new altar, okay? So there was no problems. 54, look at what time and what day the heathen had profaned it, even in that it was dedicated with songs and whatever that is, and harps and cymbals. Then all the people fell upon their faces, worshiping and praising God of heaven, who had given them good success. And so they kept the dedication of the altar 8 days and offered burnt offerings with gladness and sacrificed the sacrifice of deliverance and praise. So they had rededicated the temple on the 25th day of Kislev. Now notice in the second book of Maccabees, chapter 1, this is now later, and the writer is looking back on the event and describing it. And he says this, what time as Demetrius reigned in the 139th year, we the Jews wrote unto you the extremity of trouble that came upon us in those years, from the time that Jason and his company revolted from the Holy Land and kingdom, burned the porch, and shed innocent blood. Then we prayed unto the Lord and were heard. We offered also sacrifices and fine flour and lighted the lamps. That's the fine flour, it's the showbread, and lighted the lamps, the menorah in the holy place, and or the inner room, and set forth the loaves. And now see that ye keep the Feast of Tabernacles in the month of Kislev. What? Here he's connecting Sukkot to Hanukkah in the month of Kislev, 2 months after the feast. Now later in chapter 10, we get another reference to Hanukkah being looked at like Sukkot. Chapter 10, 2 Maccabees, verse 5. Now upon the same day that the strangers profaned the temple, on the very same day it was cleansed again. See, he set up the altar, if you remember, reading on the 25th day. And now here it is. We are on the 25th day of the same month, Kislev. And they kept the 8 days with gladness, as in the Feast of Tabernacles. Remembering that not long ago they had held the Feast of Tabernacles when as they wandered in the mountains and dens like beasts. So they're definitely trying to connect some of the meaning and the purpose of the sanctified, set-apart Feast of the Lord, Sukkot, to Hanukkah. Why? And how? What religious kind of, thinking gets them from that point to the other point? I mean, I can see it on the first year. You can kind of, think, okay, yeah, well, we haven't been able to keep the feast for a long time. Here we got this great thing. Let's do it for 8 days like we do the feast. Okay, great. But then the next year, you can keep the feast on the feast, right? They're free to do that. They got the temple back, right? So why then refer to Hanukkah as a sort of additional feast of tabernacles? It's interesting. What basis, right? Well, that brings me to third and probably the most important and probably actual reason, or best reason, I think, for the 8 days. And that's because there's biblical instruction and example concerning the dedication of the temple. Okay, when the temple was first dedicated, Solomon's temple, it took 7 days to cleanse, and then on the eighth day it was sanctified and done. This is the example we have from Solomon and the dedication of the temple to begin with. We read it in 2 Chronicles chapter 7. At that time, Solomon kept the feast 7 days, keeping the feast, Sukkot, and all Israel with him, a very great assembly from the entrance of Hamath to the brook of Egypt. And on the eighth day, they held a sacred assembly, for they observed the dedication of the altar 7 days. So for 7 days of the feast, they observed the dedication of the altar and the feast 7 days. Same 7 days. On the 23rd day of the seventh month, he sent the people away to their tents, joyful and glad of heart for the good that the Lord had done for David, for Solomon, for his people. What's this telling us? That the temple was first dedicated on the Feast of Tabernacles, on Sukkot. Leviticus 23 tells us that the feast is when? When's the feast start? On the 15th, right? Okay, it starts on the 15th. It goes for 7 days, and then there's the eighth day, right? So if it starts on the 15th, 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th, 20th, 21, 22, verse 10, then on the 23rd day, he sent the people away to their tents, joyful and glad of heart. It takes us right to the 23rd. It's over. Go home. Just like this says. So the first time that the temple was dedicated, it was on the Feast of Tabernacles. The altar dedicated for 7 days and then celebrated on the eighth. And so when they rededicated it, they would have liked for it to have been associated with the Feast of Tabernacles. But they missed it by 2 months. Okay? They wanted it to be the same dedication as it was before, but they weren't going to wait 10 months to do it. So they make it 8 days, like the feast, and they try to attach the meaning of Sukkot to Hanukkah. But it wasn't Sukkot. You can't make it Sukkot. Even if you want it to be Sukkot, you can't make it Sukkot. No matter how Jewy you are, you can't. You aren't God, right? You can't set a Moedim, a Moad. You can't establish an appointed time. That's God's doing. Okay? So that's the history. That's the history. It's not a commanded assembly. It's not a time appointed and set by God. It's not one of his feasts. Okay. But it is a bona fide, biblical, non-pagan event. It is. The temple was desecrated. It was taken over. It was regained by the Jews. It was rededicated, and sacrifices were resumed. It was a victory for Israel. There's no question about that. So there are many in the Hebrew Roots movement, and of course the Messianic Jews, that celebrate Hanukkah today, apart from Judaism. Why? What connection would one have on this side of Yeshua to celebrate or observe, or whatever you want to say, Hanukkah? Well, for one, we already sort of touched on it, okay, is the prophetic implications, right? Hanukkah does point to the Antichrist and the time of the end. I read to you in Maccabees that the idols, the prostitution, the swine being sacrificed in the temple, it was all an abomination that made the temple desolate of God's presence. Daniel prophesied this around 600 BC. Daniel 9, verse 27 says that he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week, but in the middle of the week he shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering, and on the wing of abomination shall be one who makes desolate, even until the consummation, which is determined, is poured out on the desolate. Like much in prophecy, this is dual in nature. We know that for sure. Why? Because this was written before Hanukkah, before the temple was taken over and then rededicated. So that the abomination that makes desolate occurred after he wrote this in Solomon's temple. Okay? It happened during the time of Maccabees, and it will happen again. Why do we know that? Because Yeshua, God, told us so. Matthew chapter 24. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand. Then let those who are in Judea, flee to the mountains. So, Yeshua knew that it had already been fulfilled once. And that's just something, you know, I'm not going to get into prophecy, but that's a very consistent theme almost in prophecy, is many things are very dual in nature. So this is confirmed by Yeshua to happen again. Now, I want you to look back at Daniel and put that back up on the screen. Notice that it says 1 week. Now, prophetically, a week is 7 years. Trust me on that. A day and a year for a day. So in the middle of the week would be what? 3.5 years. Okay, half of 7 days is, you know, 3.5 years. So what this is saying is the sacrifices will be cut off for 3.5 years. That's the prophecy of Daniel, right? Now, look at what the historian Flavius Josephus writes about the takeover of the temple. The king, Antiochus IV Epiphanes, being thereto disposed beforehand, complied with them, and came upon the Jews with a great army, took their city by force, and slew a great multitude of those that favored Ptolemy, and sent out his soldiers to plunder them without mercy. He also spoiled the temple and put a stop to the constant practice of offering a daily sacrifice of expiation for 3 years and 6 months. 3.5 years. Exactly as Daniel prophesied. And as Yeshua said, when you see this happen again, right? So we know it's going to happen again. So in this way, we kind of have a connection, sort of, with Hanukkah. Because what happened then, guys, according to Yeshua, what happened then is going to happen again. It's going to happen again. The temple will be desolated again. It will need to be cleansed. It will need to be rededicated. And that brings me, all of this brings me to the point that I want to make today. We'll just have one point, and then we'll discuss it. It's the biggest lesson, the biggest connection that we have as believers in Yeshua with Hanukkah. And that is this. 1 Corinthians 6. Do you not know that your body is a temple of the Ruach HaKodesh, which is in you, which you have from God? You are not your own, for you are bought with a price. Therefore, glorify God in your body and in your spirit, the temple which are God's. Each one of us, guys, is the temple. We are the temple. And that temple is prophesied by Daniel and confirmed by Yeshua to be made desolate. So understanding that, what lessons can be extracted from this story, from their experience, from this example? Remember, Alexander the Great and the fact that he was, you know, a pretty good king, a benevolent king. He allowed the people to exist in society without insisting upon them following his religion. Religion freedom, you might say. You might even say separation of church and state. Yeah, there's nothing new under the sun. Even though the Israelite people, the Jews as people say, were free to continue to follow Torah, they were slowly affected by the Greek society that was around them. They allowed that influence to creep in and modify their behavior, their perspective, and their resolution to serve Yehovah. To the point that when Antiochus came on the scene, they lost the temple. Do you think God would have allowed that temple, to his temple, where he was dwelling, to be overrun? I don't think he was there when it got overrun. By that time, the people had just, just whatever, it's a temple. I don't know. But I have to believe that if God was still there, he was not going to allow. Right? So they had slipped to that point, right? I mean, a rabbi of all people willing to sacrifice a pig on an altar to Zeus inside the temple, on the altar to God? Come on! How far they had slipped from their relationship with God. And we find ourselves, people, in an identical environment, at least for the moment, okay? Because we have supposedly this religious, we have a benevolent king that's allowing us, has been, to do as we choose religiously. When the evil one comes to put up his altar in your part of the temple, will the future Antiochus be successful? Will you allow swine to be sacrificed? Will you allow it to even enter your temple? The Jews celebrate Hanukkah rightfully as a time of rededication. That's what the word means. That's what it is. And ironically, I had this thought that they do this and they don't even have a temple now. Right? They don't even have a temple, yet they celebrate this. And so, you know, it occurs to me, to be honest, actually, we have more reason to celebrate this than they do. Because we're the ones with the temple. We're the ones that should be in a process of rededication all the time of our temple. We're the ones that probably need to stop and think about making sure that that temple is dedicated to keep it clean and rededicate if need be, right? And there is, of course, nothing wrong with that. If someone wants to acknowledge this story, to acknowledge the impact of it in our day and time, I don't see anything wrong with that. Now, there's a lot of traditions of men that are associated with it, and I'm not going to go into. I don't want to start practicing Judaism in Hanukkah, okay? But noticing this and seeing it and understanding and thinking about it and looking at it, you don't look at it as something evil, especially if it results in you taking stock of your life, of repenting, making some sound life changes. But I'm not really sure that the people that are celebrating it are doing it for that reason. Many of them just want a replacement for Christmas and a reason to give some gifts and a reason to do all of those things with a different name. And then there's others that truly believe that it is a holy festival, that it is a God-ordained festival like Sukkot, and it is not. But that does not mean, I'm trying to have some balance here on both sides, right? It does not mean that it doesn't have value in the lesson. Valuing and acknowledging the event as it applies to us today, the ones that really do have the temple. You know, we celebrate Independence Day on the 4th of July, don't we? We blow up fireworks, we maybe camp at the lake or have friends and family over for a barbecue. Why? Why do we do that? Because we want to acknowledge the significance of that day. So we don't see that as sin. Of course not, because there's no pagan influence in that. There's nothing. It's not a religious holiday, right? Okay? And so if looked at properly, to acknowledge Hanukkah in the context of this was a war that resulted in freedom, okay? We had a war here that resulted in freedom, okay, for the 4th of July. And so to look at it that way, it's not a sin. But it's not a sin to ignore it either. I mean, if you want to ignore it, you're not practicing Jew. So, you know. But if you ignore it, I will say this: you'll miss out on all the fried foods. One of the things that they do on Hanukkah, they eat a lot of fried foods. Why? Because it's a reference back to the oil that lasted. So they fry a bunch of stuff in oil. So, I don't know. We're all eating fried foods. Well, I guess all of us are. More people are keeping Hanukkah than you think, I guess. Okay, anyway. To me personally, what I see valuable, more valuable, is the connection with the feast, with Sukkot. We can have the attitude of Hanukkah and take these lessons. And instead of doing it in Kislev, where they're trying to make it some second Sukkot, We can take these things and maybe even around this time it can remind us of this and look at that on Sukkot and be thinking about the fact that we are the temple, that we do need to rededicate ourselves. You know, the feast is 7 days. Just like there's 7 days to dedicate, to cleanse and to consecrate the altar, okay, of our temple. And that plays into the analogy of the feast. Because, you know, you have 7 days of the feast, and they had 7 days of dedication of the altar. Okay? And then you had the last day where they celebrated the completion of that. And that relates right back to the Feast of Tabernacles, doesn't it? We have a millennium where we're going to be helping people cleanse their temple and dedicate themselves to the great God. And then on the eighth day, the final judgment, all of it wraps up, and there's this huge celebration of the fullness of the kingdom of God and the temple being complete and God coming down and dwelling in that temple. And that's what they were celebrating. It really does. I can see why they wanted it to be Sukkot. But it's not. So let's take that and let's put it in Sukkot where it belongs. But there's certainly nothing wrong with when we get to this time of year. I mean, the feast was 2 months ago. A lot of things can happen to you in 2 months. And so, if somebody comes up to you and says Happy Hanukkah, or you see Happy Hanukkah on a TV, or some liberal Democrat tries to pretend she likes Hanukkah, you know, you can still think, oh yeah, it can remind you and maybe give you pause to think about your own temple, to think about, you know, what it's an opportunity, okay, that comes along that might poke us to examine ourselves, to repent, to cleanse and rededicate ourselves to God. And that's not a bad thing, so long as it's not a pagan mixture to where we start engaging in traditions of men that Yeshua had a lot to say about. Not just the pagan traditions of men, but he talked to those Pharisees a lot about their traditions of men, right? And so it's not a bad thing to think about. Again, so that it's not a pagan mixture. And Hanukkah is not that. But like I said, it's not a set apart feast. It's not a feast of the Lord either. So when Hanukkah comes and goes each year and you hear this, maybe you reflect on your condition, on your temple. Mm-hmm. You know, like I said, it's ironic that most of it applies more to us as believers in Yeshua than it does for practicers of Judaism. Everything about that tabernacle, every single element in that thing, I've given messages on it. Everything about that, and then that is the pattern that Solomon used to build the temple. The temple's patterned right off it. Everything in there points to Yeshua. He is the temple. And when he lives in us, we become the temple. Okay? We had the temple. You know, I had to force myself to keep from going down, you know, so many rabbit trails, because there's so many things that we could talk about in relation to Hanukkah and that menorah and, you know, the temple and all of these things. It all points to Yeshua, every last bit of it. So as I just wrap this up, I want to say that my hope is that maybe you see Hanukkah in a little different light. And while it's not a set-apart festival of God, it is part of the roots of our faith. It's part of our history as a people. And it contains within it a very important lesson that the temple of God, each of us, can be overrun with idols if we are not extremely diligent to make sure that the society and the influences around us don't successfully invade that temple. And we need to be diligent whenever we recognize this happening to take up our sword like Judah Maccabee did and slay those influences, cleanse that temple, and rededicate it to the service of the great God. Amen.